Well, I'm pleased to be with you here today. I know I'm brand new for, I've met many of you and you've been so warm and welcoming, and several of you I have yet to meet, but here's a good way for us to get to know each other. My husband Matthew and I just got back from a long road trip. Our family sedan died just before Christmas, which was also right around the time that my in-laws had offered to sell us one of their used cars, so that was perfect timing. But less perfect is the fact that my in-laws and their cars live in California. So about 2 weeks ago, Matthew and I flew out to the coast to take possession of our new used car and drive it back home. It's a long drive. And on the way, we spent a few nights in beautiful Sedona, Arizona, to celebrate a very belated 20-year wedding anniversary. Sedona is an interesting place, and I found it to be a particularly interesting place to contemplate the Transfiguration account. This area is full of natural beauty of the Red Rock Mountains, and there's hiking trails that we enjoyed. It's all stunning and beautiful. But the high places of Sedona's mountains also have a reputation for being spiritual vortices. I don't know if you've heard of this before, but they are claiming that these are places where the transcendent glory touches us here on earth. Maybe this is too close to me. There are a number of hikes and locations that are advertised as being touch points of energy, places where we might expect the supernatural to mingle with our own physical bodies. Sedona's website says that the visiting seeker or devotee may feel a range of sensations, from a slight tingling on exposed skin to a vibration emanating from the ground. But apart from the stunning nature of God's creation and the joys of relaxing with my husband on vacation, most of what I vibed in Sedona was materialism. Everywhere I looked, I saw parking lots that were crowded, expensive coffee shops, and stand after stand selling crystals and herbs and amulets, all filled with folks that were hoping to take advantage of this instinct to linger in a place where supernatural energy might be present. And it made me ask, is experience seeking where spiritual depth and truth comes from? In today's text, I think Jesus' disciples are having a similar misunderstanding. And if they were vulnerable to it, then I have to assume we are as well. Peter saw Jesus transfigured. He saw him chatting in bodily form with Moses and Elijah, saints long departed. He saw the glory of heaven on earth, and he wanted to stay there. He wanted more of this experience. Of course he did. But Jesus was on this mountain to discuss the suffering that was to come, the will of God that he was submitting to in obedience. The Transfiguration story is important to Jesus' story, and it's included in all three synoptic gospels, and we touch on it every year in the church calendar. It assures us that Jesus is not only human, but also divine, that he is God and man. We see that it is in Jesus, not a mountain or a vortex point, that heaven and earth touch. And we see that God has a plan, that God is in control, and God is not going to be surprised by all the very surprising things that are about to happen in Jesus' life then and in our lives now. But within this comfort is a challenge for us also, because we, like Peter, are not invited to linger here on this mountain of experience. Luke's version of the story and our text for today begins with an intriguing phrase. 8 days after Jesus said all this, can you imagine walking into a room where a movie is on and you see those words on a screen? 8 days after he said this, I think we'd leap for the remote and say, wait, 8 days after who said what? Because we know we'll be lost if we don't hear the setup. So before we look too closely at what happened with Jesus on the mountain, let's remember what happened 8 days ago, which conveniently for us was our text for last Sunday, so only 7 days ago for us. Let me read you a bit of it. When Jesus was praying in private and his disciples were with him, he asked them, "Who do the crowds say that I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others that one of the prophets of long ago has come back to life." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "God's Messiah." Jesus strictly warned them not to tell anyone, and he said, "The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life." Then he said to them all, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross daily and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for my sake will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world and yet lose or forfeit their own soul?" About 8 days after Jesus said this, he took Peter, James, and John with him and went up into a mountain to pray. So Jesus has just asked his closest friends what the crowds think of him. And the consensus is that he is definitely a holy man sent from God. They're guessing maybe John the Baptist is back. Maybe this is Elijah or another prophet. But the disciples confess that they know the truth. Jesus is not just a prophet. Jesus is God's Messiah. Jesus is the one that God has fully endorsed as King, King of Kings. And here's the thing, they're right. Jesus is the Messiah, but they don't understand what this means. For generations, Israel has waited for the Messiah to come and save them from the empires that were oppressing, occupying, and exiling them. The Messiah, they imagined, would overthrow Rome, bringing relief from suffering. He would make their nation great again. Yet God's plan for his Messiah was very different, and it somehow centered around the suffering, rejection, and death, not of their enemies, but of their Messiah. And then Jesus takes Peter, James, and John with him up a mountain to pray. This makes sense. Jesus frequently went away to pray, but on this day, things take a turn. What happens next is hard to make sense of. Even Peter, who was there watching with his own eyes, didn't understand what he was seeing. But as we look closely, I think we'll find a number of clues. And these clues fit together like a puzzle or like this beautiful stained glass behind me. Each piece looks nice and impressive on its own, but it's when we put them all together that the full picture comes through. So let's take a look at these pieces one by one. The first clue I see is who Jesus takes with him, Peter, John, and James. It's an interesting choice. If you're familiar with the Gospels, you may realize that these are Jesus' closest friends, the three he confides in most frequently. But the last time these three were alone with Jesus, just one page ago, just a few days ago, they saw him raise a little girl from the dead. Today, these same three will witness Jesus chatting with Moses and Elijah. They have not been dead for a few hours. They have been dead for centuries. And Jesus is not going to raise them back into daily life, but somehow they will appear in a kind of heavenly resurrected body. In both these instances, it happens just days apart. These three men are the only disciples that Jesus allows to witness a profound act of God's transcendent power over death. God's glory overcoming our mortal existence. All of this unbelievable idea made real and visible before them in Jesus. The second clue I see is where Jesus takes Peter, James, and John and why. Up a mountain in order to pray. Both the location of the mountain as well as the activity of prayer are things that we have historically tended to associate with drawing near to God. In prayer, of course, we quiet ourselves and center ourselves, remembering that we are in God's presence, speaking directly to God. And as the psalmist who said, "I lift my eyes to the hills," reminds us, and as my trip to Sedona demonstrates, we tend to associate climbing a mountain with coming near to God's presence and glory. But as Jesus was praying on this mountain, his face changes. His clothes become like lightning. And this is another clue. It might remind us of Moses and how he looked after meeting with God on Mount Sinai. It might remind us of the man who in just a few weeks will be standing at Jesus' empty tomb, shining like lightning and telling the women that Jesus is not there, for though he was killed and buried, he's alive. In other words, as he prays on this mountain, Jesus begins to look like someone from the place beyond life and death, the place where God's glory dwells in fullness and eternity. And speaking of Moses, he's here. And this is another clue. Jesus is suddenly joined by Moses and Elijah. How is this possible? I do not have an answer for that. Notably, both Moses and Elijah were long gone from this earth. Each of them in their lifetimes had received revelations from God on a mountain, and each were expected to come again in the Messianic age. And suddenly, they're here, right now, right in front of Peter and James and John. So Jesus is standing there, transformed into a not quite earthly looking being, having a meeting with two saints of old who are long dead and gone. For Peter, James, and John, that's a lot to take in. But equally stunning is the topic of their meeting. Jesus, Moses, and Elijah are discussing Jesus' departure and how it will be fulfilled in Jerusalem. Now, this is a very important clue, because the word used for departure here in the Greek is the same as Exodus. And so it carries a double meaning for Luke as he writes. Yes, Jesus is going to depart, but more, Jesus' departure will be linked to the events of the Passover, the Passover lamb, the flight from slavery in Egypt, and God's liberation of his people from slavery and into a new worshiping society. In fact, what we know now, and what it seems that Jesus and Moses and Elijah knew at the time, at this meeting, is that this Exodus is going to take place this Passover. The liberation that Jesus brings is going to happen in just a few weeks in the holy city. And as an aside, how amazing would it be to watch Jesus discuss his Exodus with Moses, of all people? Talk about a stunning assurance that God is in control through all generations. And let's not miss this clue, this piece of the puzzle. By eavesdropping on this incredible supernatural miracle meeting, we learn that all that will take place in Jerusalem, Jesus' rejection, his suffering, his death, is not a surprise. This was God's plan all along. It's being discussed in heavenly committee meetings. It's well thought out. It's been agreed upon in advance. But while it's not a surprise to God or to Jesus or to those in the heavenly realm, suffering, rejected, dying Messiah is the very opposite of what everyone on earth expects. They cannot wrap their minds around it. Peter, James, and John have heard Jesus explain this several times, and they still cannot believe it or even seem to take it in. But then comes the cloud and the voice. As Jesus' face shining on the mountain reminds us of Moses' face long ago, this cloud reminds us of God's presence on Mount Sinai, later filling the temple, and the voice reminds us of Jesus' baptism. The cloud signifies God physically appearing. The theological word for this is theophany. Joining this already unlikely supernatural meeting to vocally confirm all that Jesus is saying and doing. Jesus is God's king. God is endorsing and signing off on Jesus. This is God's plan and God's kingdom. Jesus is God's king. So even as we are learning that God is in control of all that has happened and all that is about to happen, we are reminded that our instructions come from Jesus. Our job is to listen to him. Peter takes in as much of this as he can, and he is psyched, as we used to say in the 90s. He believes Jesus is the Messiah. He has seen the glory, and he wants to hold on to it forever. God's glory is what he has been seeking his whole life. It's what he left everything behind for. And as the men start to leave, Peter takes his shot. What if we built tents and stayed here forever? This, I think, is the climax of the story and the deepest meaning of the story. They are not here to stay. The entire point of this visit was to discuss Jesus' departure, his exodus, his suffering, just as Jesus described 8 days ago at length, that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the teachers and must be killed and on the third day raised to life, and that whoever wants to follow Jesus must deny themselves and take up their cross daily to follow him. This is the very opposite of setting up camp in a glorious place where heaven seems to be touching earth. As the text tells us, Peter did not know what he was saying. In fact, the next day they go back down the mountain and Jesus says it again in verse 44. Let these words sink into your ears. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed. And still the disciples cannot understand. To demonstrate just how mixed up they are, their response to this somber warning is to start arguing about who is going to be greatest in Jesus' kingdom. So, when we put all these pieces of the puzzle together, all the pieces of the stained glass together, what do we see? What does Jesus' transfiguration teach us and mean for us? We often use this story as a metaphor for remembering to go home after a retreat or after a special mountaintop experience. Like the men of Faith Covenant today enjoying their men's retreat, realizing that in a few hours they'll need to come home, or like my husband and I packing up from Sedona and making the long drive across the country. But that's common sense. We know that weekend retreats and vacations come to an end. And what is happening to Jesus on this mountain is the very opposite of common sense. Peter, James, and John not only don't tell anyone, they don't understand. This is a secret so hidden that even those looking right at it, having it explained to them over and over again, cannot grasp it. In the transfiguration of Jesus, we are invited to remember and receive this almost unbelievable truth, that Jesus is where God and humanity meet. It is in Jesus that heaven and earth come together, where creator and creation touch and mingle. In Jesus, the transcendent glory and power of God over life and death is revealed and is touched by their hands. For Peter, James, and John, it's real, and they have seen it. These friends saw it when Jesus raised a young girl back from the dead, and they saw it when Jesus transformed into lightning as he spoke with saints long gone from this world. They saw it as the cloud of God's glory enveloped them, and as God's voice audibly named Jesus as his son, the one they should listen to. But for them, this was not a spiritual retreat. It was the opposite of that. The point of this meeting is to discuss the suffering that lies ahead. There are no shortcuts to God's kingdom and glory. In this world, there is trouble. Peter believes in the glory, in the transcendence. He wants to build tents and stay here in a nearly resurrected state with God's glory and the communion of saints all around him. This would be a wonderful shortcut to resurrection without death, to escaping the evils of the world without suffering. But if they stay here in seeming victory, they lose everything. Because the path to Jesus' kingdom is not through grasping the privileges of his status, but in remaining obedient, even in rejection, even in death. In the church calendar every year, Transfiguration Sunday is celebrated right before the beginning of Lent. The reason for this, I think, is because as Jesus comes down the mountain, he turns his face towards Jerusalem and begins the long journey to the cross, just as we begin to reflect on during Lent. And as we head into this season, the season of Lent, the season of confession, and whatever the coming weeks and months hold in our real lives, I think we need to marinate in the meaning of the Transfiguration. There is challenge for us here in the story, and there is comfort. Our first comfort is that Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus is the Son of God. His friends saw with their eyes and touched with their hands that in his body he held a life that was divine, somehow transcending death. As John will later write, Jesus is that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen from our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched. Have there been moments in your own life when you have been stunned, shaken, taken aback by the sudden realization of the glory of God, of Jesus' presence, that God is real, that God knows you, that God is right here? These moments are such gifts, but they are so rare. And there's no place where we can go to ensure that they will happen, or no formula that we can play out to receive them. They are gifts from God, maybe only once or twice in a lifetime. But we hold on to them because they keep us going during times of suffering or times of doubt or times of monotony. When we struggle to believe, we keep our eyes on that which we have seen with our eyes and touched with our hands. And I invite you to take just a brief second to bring to mind those moments when you have seen God, when you have been sure that God was before you, that God was beautiful, and that God knew you. Our second comfort is that God is in control. This heavenly meeting between Jesus, Elijah, and Moses regarding the details of Jesus' liberating suffering and death took place weeks before he was arrested in Jerusalem. God's purpose for the Messiah are surprising. They're exactly the opposite of what we're expecting, but to God, they are not a surprise. God's own voice speaks from the cloud and asks us to receive this, to listen to Jesus and to follow. God is not surprised by evil. God is not surprised that this beautiful, precious world is enslaved to death. God is not surprised by our deadly choices and the choices of those around us. Our redemption story is in God's unshakable hands. So I invite you to take another moment to receive this comfort too, to think of your anxieties and the suffering that you know lies ahead, and remember that God is not surprised. And now the challenge. We are still swayed by a desire to believe that the Messiah is glory without suffering, that God's kingdom looks like victory without surrender. We are still following those who promise security and power. But Jesus is heading down the mountain into Jerusalem, and he asks us to follow him. As we head into the real-life complexities of following Jesus in 2025, as we head into the Lenten season, are we Easter resurrection people, or are we people of the cross? For followers of Jesus, they cannot be separated. We cannot stay with Jesus if we try to build shelters and magical places where the glory of heaven touches earth and shields us from the realities of suffering and evil. Not here on the mountain for Peter, James, and John, not for the devotees shopping for spiritual experiences in Sedona, and not for us here today. Jesus is walking down the mountain, heading into Jerusalem, where he will confront those misusing God's name out of their own greed to harm others. There are no shortcuts to God's kingdom glory. There is only following Jesus and trusting that he is the Son of God, that he transcends everything we have ever seen or touched, and that he will lead us to new and glorious life. In closing, I want to read to you the words from two hymns. One was written 200 years ago for Transfiguration Sunday, and the second hymn was written 2,000 years ago to speak of Jesus the Messiah. O wondrous sight, O vision fair, of glory that the church shall share, which Christ upon the mountain shows, where brighter than the sun he glows. The law and prophets there have place, two chosen witnesses of grace. The Father's voice from out the cloud proclaims his only Son aloud. With shining face and bright array, Christ deigns to manifest that day. What glory shall be theirs above, who joy in God with perfect love. Friends, Jesus is our King, and his glory awaits us. We do not need to be afraid. And the second hymn, I think you'll find familiar. Christ Jesus, in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, and being found in human likeness, he became in appearance as a man and humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father.